Hi friends, before we go forward, we would like to thank, as always, our wonderful patrons. It's quite amazing, actually. I can't explain to you what a nice feeling it is. I don't know if nice is the word. Gratifying feeling it is when people decide to pay for your work. It's quite astounding. So, gosh, Julie Campbell, Leah, no last name, just like Kylie. Amanda McCartan, Claire, no last name. Alice Anwar, Jane Margaret, Marsha Abraham, Sarah Heisler, Karen Costa, Brooke Elise Griffin, lots of names. Shari Davidson, Susan Pockney, Emily Williams, Jess Wood, Emily McKenzie, Leonie Wilson, and Sarah Herbert. Thank you so much to our lovely patrons. If you'd like to become a patron of Australian True Crime, just go to patreon.com/AustTrueCrimePod. That's AUST True Crime Pod. And you can just click on some links and become a patron there. And you get extra stuff. You get extra episodes. You get some events. We've got our first events coming up in January. And we have lots more stuff in store. We've got a person. Who I know, Zoe is her name. She's a beautiful person. And she works for the Cates, you know, from catering and Get Kraken. Yeah, well, that's where I found her. And she's been working on my personal website and store shop that I have over there with Buddhist stuff in it. She's now going to be running the Patreon and helping us to make sure that you guys get lots of good stuff for your hard-earned cash. So if you would like to get into that, please go to patreon.com/AustTrueCrimePod and show you care with cash, as I used to say to my mother on my birthdays. Okay, on with the show. A couple of weeks ago, we featured an interview with a lady called Elaine, who'd been working in a Melbourne jewellery shop when it was violently robbed by young men of African appearance, as they say in the newspapers. That happened to Elaine not once, but twice, would you believe? On the first occasion, Elaine had a gun held to her head by one of the perpetrators. She's now suffering terribly with PTSD.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
If you haven't heard that episode yet, it might be a good idea to go back and have a listen before you go on with this one, because today we'll hear from a representative of Victoria Police about some of the issues she raised. Commander Stuart Bateson was a homicide detective for many years and a member of the famous Piranha Task Force, formed in 2003 to deal with the Melbourne gang war that was raging at the time between Carl Williams and the Carlton crew. So Stuart definitely knows a gang when he sees one, and he's now the head of the African Australian Community Task Force. He sat down with me recently to talk through the facts and the fiction of the so-called African crime wave in Melbourne.
I know you can't speak specifically about Elaine's case either, so but I just wanted you to maybe be aware of her. And I know that Elaine has some frustrations that you guys would hear a lot of, not even to do with African gangs, but the idea that the police took too long to come, and how come the police station's only 6 minutes away, but it took them 35 minutes to get here, and those sorts of things. Can you speak, not specifically to Elaine's case, but how is it sometimes that police, you know, what don't we understand about suburban policing that way?
Well, it's often difficult to talk about individual cases, yeah, but we do know that, generally speaking, our frontline members who are out on the divisional van are fully engaged. So they are at a variety of jobs that could go from assisting someone to, you know, at their home at a very low level, to a really serious crime that Elaine experienced.
So when you say fully engaged, is that police speak for very busy?
Very busy.
Okay.
You know, the full day, I mean, we often talk to members on the front line and they don't have time for lunch. Yep. They don't stop. They're lucky if they can grab a coffee and they eat the sandwiches, and you sometimes look inside their divisional van and you go, oh, my God, they are living in here.
Looks like my car.
So they are absolutely flat out every day. All day, and often have to require to stay back to complete their paperwork at the end of the day. So I hear stories constantly that they're there for 2 hours afterwards just to get the requirements done, because they are out on the road from the minute they start to the minute they finish. So it all depends on when calls come in, on where they may be. Very rarely they're parked at the police station waiting to respond. They might be at a family violence incident 2 kilometres or 6 kilometres, depending on where they are. Sometimes in the country, they might be an hour away from the police station.
Mm.
That's just the reality of the life. So sometimes our response times do differ. But what I can say, crimes like Elaine's are given the top priority. And I know police officers, as a culture, we want to get there. When those crimes happen, we are going as hard as we can to get there. Sometimes when we know the offenders have already left, we may go to their immediate surrounds and make sure that we can't capture those offenders. When we've already got information they've left and no one's injured to the point of needing medical assistance as a real priority, we may say, well, let's go and see if we can find them around there because they've only just left. So that's a priority in young police officers' minds too. You know, how do we best capture these guys? What do we prioritise in terms of our response?
That makes sense. Now, so rather than going to where they've been, maybe try and get to where they are.
Yeah. So we have all these things that are going through our mind. But if someone was injured there and someone was in need of medical assistance, of course they'd go there. But I can tell you every police officer I know would prioritise these types of jobs at the very highest level, and they will move heaven and earth to get there. They are certainly not sitting around waiting for things to happen. They are busy and they may well be further away than they would have liked. And sometimes, of course, as a victim, and I would be like this myself, I want to see those blue shirts next to me making sure I'm safe. And we know that's a priority for us too. But sometimes we have to think through, well, is it better for us to actually try and capture them now, provide that support in 20 minutes, 15 minutes? That's something that is really on a case-by-case individual basis.
Well, and we have to say in Elaine's case, there were two gangs, if I can use that word, which I hate using, but I don't know what else to use, totalling about 10 young men, and all of those young men were captured by police and all of those young men entered some kind of detention as a result of that investigation. So you got there.
Yeah, we as I said, we prioritise this work and we work very hard. And in this particular spate of robberies, I know we put significant resources into finding out who did those crimes and making sure they were caught quickly. And as I said, I know a couple of the detectives involved and they worked massive hours on this case and others.
Elaine believes, and I Googled and I couldn't find any reports of this, but Elaine believes that a Lebanese jewellery shop owner was charged and convicted of planning these robberies. I'm sorry, do you know anything specifically about this?
What I can say is people were charged at the other end of the spectrum.
Yep, okay.
And those matters, as I understand it, are still before the court. That's so right. I can't really comment
sense.
on the details of it. But absolutely, there was people, like if you're going to rob a jewellery store, you need to know where you're going to get rid of it.
Well, I thought that at the time, you know. I thought to myself, where are Sudanese teenagers getting rid of $300,000 worth of jewellery?
And, you know, that was part of the investigation, and we're proud to say that, you know, we think we've got the people that were disposing, you know, they were disposing it off to, you know, that jewellery too. So, but those matters are before the court. I think they haven't got a final outcome as yet. So we had a spate over a couple of months and, you know, same question occurred to us.
Mm.
You know, if you're going to steal jewellery, where's it going?
Yeah.
Once we established where it was going, we put a bit of resources into investigating that at the same time. And you know, as we say, we charged three people with receiving those stolen goods. And effectively, that put us a stop to that spate of offending.
I'll just pop in here to say that after the interview, police media supplied me with some more information about this. In October of 2017, a person described by the Herald Sun newspaper as a flamboyant Colombian-born jewellery dealer with a premises in Melbourne's CBD was charged with possession of stolen goods, recklessly possessing stolen goods, and handling stolen goods as part of the investigation into the spate of jewellery shop robberies. Two other men, both Colombian nationals, were also arrested and charged with the same offences. And those charges are in front of the courts as we speak. So we have no further updates at the moment, but I will certainly let you know how that goes. A number of people have contacted me via social media to say that a Lebanese gang was behind the robberies, but it turns out that that is the first piece of commonly shared misinformation we can put to rest.
Well, look, I think it's important to say that, you know, Elaine's experience is unfortunately not hers alone.
Mm.
There has been other people that have been victims of terrible crimes. You know, yeah. The aggravated burglaries caused tremendous trauma. And for those people, their lives will never be the same.
No.
And for the people that know them well, of course they're scared. And, you know, that I think is totally understandable and cannot be understated. But Melbournes are not scared. You know, Melburnians as a whole, you see the city thriving on a Friday and Saturday night, even during the week.
Mm.
People are out enjoying their lives. And so I think the broader conversation that when we start to speak in generalisations really provides an inaccuracy of the situation.
It's interesting too, isn't it, that it was only 10 years ago, maybe 13 years ago, that Jason Moran was shot dead at a kid's footy game in the suburbs in front of his children and in front of other children and parents. And no member of the government ever came out and said, Melburnians are scared to go to the football or go to the park on the weekend.
Yeah, I was part of the Piranha Task Force during that period, and it was a serious pressure on the police to solve those, but it was a very different narrative.
Yes. Why is that? Is it, Matt, can I ask you this horrible, horrible question? Is it because these boys are black?
Well, look, I think part of the equation is that when in that gangland war, the people that were getting injured were other criminals.
Well, people say that all the time, but then I think, you know, Alphonse and, was it Jason, you know, bashed and hospitalised people in nightclubs.
True.
Unknown business owners around Melbourne who were being shaken down for years by these people. I mean, I feel like it's kind of an unfair characterisation to say, oh, they only hurt each other, isn't it?
Well, I think when you talk about the murders and the seriousness of the offending, you know, it was clearly. And I remember at the time there was people saying, well, the police don't even care because they're, you know, eliminating, you know, criminals
each other,
at the
yes.
same time.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of offending is a little bit different than when we talk about the aggravated burglaries and the carjackings that, you know, some people have experienced here in Melbourne.
Mm.
So I think that's a little bit different. But I also think there is a bit of the other.
Mm.
So, you know, unfortunately, the conversation starts to delve into those people and they're responsible. Well, the reality of the situation is that most of these young kids are Australian.
Well, that's the whole other thing too, isn't it? I mean, I hesitate to call these people Sudanese or African gangs. They're Australian.
They're Australian.
They're Australian citizens.
Most of them were born here.
Mm.
It doesn't reflect the reality of the situation.
Mm. So what is the reality of the situation right now from your perspective?
So we've definitely seen an increased high harm offending, and that's an issue for us, an issue that we need to tackle, and we have been tackling for
so
a couple of years.
Can I just clarify, we know that statistically the number of crimes committed by youth of African appearance, we'll use that terminology, is low. It's unlikely to happen to you, but the seriousness of the crime is statistically quite high. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, well, the problem is the numbers are so low. So whenever I hear people talk statistics, I get a little bit concerned because I think they can be altered to fit anyone's argument.
Okay.
The reality is we've probably got 100, 150 young people from South Sudanese background that are involved in this type of really high harm offending.
Mm.
And that's a concern for
us. That's enough. That's a lot.
We've seemed to have seen a reduction in some of that offending, but it's still occurring. So it's an issue that we need to grapple with. And there is a whole lot of work that's going across government and across Victoria Police and indeed the community. Mm. The community are doing fantastic work to try and make an impact on this. But the problem is that we then conflate the argument and say that it's all South Sudanese people committing these types of offences, which is just not true. And the impact that I see, and I've talked to a lot of young South Sudanese people, is they feel completely excluded and isolated and marginalised because of that, despite them doing great things. And I heard a story speaking to one young man, and he got on the train at Williams Landing with two of his friends to go to university, and half the carriage got up and moved.
Oh, God.
Because, you know, the assumption being that they were an African gang. They were on the way to university.
Three black guys on the way to university. Yeah.
Well, and we know as police we're often now getting calls where members of the public are saying they're concerned about there's a big group of African young men standing on the corner. Well, we get down there and, yeah, that's what they're doing. They're standing on the corner just hanging out with their friends.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult situation for us because we, you know, in some ways we have to respond to the call from the public and go and actually investigate what's happening. When we get there, you know, it may be nothing. So we've got to make sure that we explain that and why we're doing that to those young men, because often they feel like they're being over-policed and targeted by us.
Mm.
But it's a difficult situation.
And again, it is that other, as I've said to young South Sudanese men, they are visually outstanding in our community. They are, you know, noticeable in a way that three young white guys, no matter what, how violent their proclivities, would not be on a train. When these boys get on the train, everyone notices straight away, don't they?
They do.
And so that brings those prejudices up really quickly. They don't have to hear their accent. They don't have to hear anything. Or it's just as soon as they see them.
Mm. But I've also spoken to South Sudanese mothers who say to their kids, don't go out in groups of three or four.
Yeah.
You know, stick to ones and twos because they're worried about what's going to happen to their family. And, you know, we know that their experience, they go to shopping centres, for instance, and all of a sudden they get a sense that they're being followed by security. And, you know, this is incredibly marginalising and it's pushing people away from, you know, what the protective factors of community, making people feel welcome. So, you know, I worry that the more we push people to the side, the more we make them the other, the more likely they are to slip into offending because they feel completely excluded, completely marginalised from the broader community. You know, the answer lies in making sure that we're more connected as a community, that people feel more welcome. And when that's the case, we'll feel a whole lot safer.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a hard sell, though, isn't it? It's a hard sell when you have certain people in the community believing that, I mean, Elaine believes that they're raised that way. That's what she told me. They're raised to be thieves. That's what she told me. So when you're up against these kinds of cultural biases, it's very hard to convince people that the way through is embracing, isn't it?
It is difficult. But we know, you know, when we look across young offenders, we know their commonalities are not the colour of their skin.
Okay,
the commonalities are, you know, lack of opportunity, breakdown in their family structures, disconnection from their culture, lack of education or a problematic relationship with the education system. You know, no sporting clubs are involved, but no cultural or dance or creative space for them to meet in and enjoy. They feel very much that they're pushed to the side. So those commonalities go across a whole lot of different ethnicities, including the Anglo-Saxon community.
Yeah, absolutely.
You look at those commonalities and you start saying, well, look at the socioeconomic factor. And they're the things that we really see as common across young offenders.
Mm.
Now, those things, those types of things, the poverty, the lack of opportunity, the lack of connection to their family, culture and schooling. You know, if they're the things that we look at, they're the things we can make an impact on.
Mm.
We certainly can't change people's colour of their skin. So
no.
Let's talk about the things we can work on together.
After the break, we'll discuss some more of the most common rumours spread about African gangs in Melbourne. Coming up on Australian True Crime, is it true that Sudanese refugees are getting lots of free stuff that you and your family aren't? Like people keep telling me on Facebook. But first, is it true that Sudanese criminals are treated differently by police? Like you keep telling me on Facebook.
So this is the thing, you know, it's a much broader issue than just the police. I mean, in some ways, you look at our job is to make sure that we're holding offenders to account, that we're investigating people and we're actually arresting people quickly and making sure that we're delivering some timely justice.
What do you say to those people who say they're a protected species, the Africans, police don't arrest them, they get a special pass? People say that to me on social media all the time. They tell me that they have overheard police saying, we can't do anything about them, mate. Talk to your politicians.
That's just not the case. Mm. The reality is that our youth justice centres we have a huge population of South Sudanese in our youth justice centres, and the figures show that clearly. We've also made so many arrests over the last 2.5 years. That is our job. We do it as well as we possibly can. And we are doing it quite well. We do get arrests and we do it reasonably quickly. In terms of the public order stuff, sometimes it's a decision on, all right, do you actually chase people down or you help people in need of assistance and move people on? So those decisions are made by our local commanders all the time. That nothing could be further than the truth that anyone's above the law or a protected species. You break the law, we'll do something about it. And I think we do that quite well. So the real thing is, how do we make an impact on those really underlying factors? Mm. Now, a lot of those things are out of the control of the police. Mm. You know, if you're talking about connection to schooling, we need to make sure that those kids have a really good connection to education system. And the Department of Education doing some great work. They've got South Sudanese workers within the school to keep them connected.
Have they?
Yeah, they're doing some fantastic work.
Because I keep hearing from the community that, you know, children sort of show up at about the age of 14 sometimes, new arrivals, who have perhaps a year two level education by our standards and are then bullied by the other kids in the school, and that can push them out of the school system as well. Have you seen anything like that?
Look, we had a report published by CMY recently that talked about some really problematic experiences from young South Sudanese people in the education system. But what I know is the Department of Education are working hard to combat that, which is great. Likewise, the Department of Health and Human Services have just started up community support groups in Dandenong, Melton and Wyndham, staffed by South Sudanese people, working on programs collectively with the community. Those sorts of things is what we need to concentrate on. This is, you know, when we talk about it as a police issue, we've absolutely got a role to play. Our role is to catch the criminals and put them before the court. There's other roles for a whole lot of different government organisations and community. You know, it was interesting when I was out in the western suburbs, one of the neighbourhood watch groups were having troubles with a group of South Sudanese young men using a park and the way they used it. And they were frightened. And eventually when we sort of talked and had a conversation about that, I said, well, where are these young men living? They said, well, they live in these two or three houses here. I said, how about you reach out? Mm. Go and knock on the doors and speak to the mums. And they did, and they had a barbecue in the park, the very park they were complaining about, and they got to understand that these families were just like them. Yeah. They were struggling. They wanted the best for their kids. And the Neighbourhood Watch Group were really able to connect them to local services that helped them. So that, you know, that kind of role for all of us, I think, is there.
That's that embracing.
It's reaching out. It's understanding some of the issues because, you know, some of the families are doing it tough, you know, and it's hard to come into a new country and be automatically connected to the support services. You don't know what's available, or you certainly don't know how to find them.
And it's a very different country, I can tell you. Like, I don't know if you've been to Africa. I know that our culture is very, very different. But for me, I didn't really get it. I'd never been to Africa before. So it wasn't until I got there that I realised how hard it must be to settle in Australia and in Melbourne. We're just very, very different culture.
Yeah.
I know a lot of our listeners will be listening thinking, oh, no, actually, probably they won't be. It'll be other people who think, well, why do they get all that stuff? That's the other rumour, the other story people say is they get everything for free. They get everything for free. Why do the schools, why does the education department, why does everyone put so many resources into them? It's this them and us thing. Are there similar resources for non-Sudanese, you know, people in our community? Because I know you work with lots of minorities.
There is. And, you know, there is.
Are they getting any more than anybody else? I mean, are they benefiting any more than anybody else?
Certainly not. I mean, there's support services for lots of communities that are struggling or find themselves, or people that find themselves in need. But we've got to mature our thinking around this and make sure that those services are culturally appropriate.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we need young people to connect and actually value that service. And if we know this from working with our Aboriginal community, that if they're not, the services are not culturally appropriate, they just don't work.
Yeah.
They just don't resonate, you know. So we need to make sure that they are delivered in a culturally appropriate way.
Mm.
Generally, best delivered by people from that community, you know, informed by community expertise, led by community people. That's what we know works.
Mm.
And in the end, that's what we want, isn't it? Something that works, something that makes communities stronger, makes communities safer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if these kids are flourishing, if these kids are succeeding, then they're not out there committing crime and scaring people.
Well, that's it. We want these kids to love the community to the extent that they don't want to hurt anybody. Why do you think, how do you think these young men justify hurting an old lady like Elaine and doing these, committing these crimes?
Look, it's complicated, and I think all of those young offenders perhaps have different motivations, but I think where they get to, generally speaking, is they feel like they're not part of society. Mm. They feel like that they're outside of it. And when they feel like they're outside of it, they don't feel like they're connected to some of the results of their offending. Mm. You know, and some of those young men are very remorseful. Others aren't.
Yeah.
And they're the challenge. They're the ones that we know are continually committing crime. But some of them are. Some of them realise what they've done and the impact that they've had. But the challenge is that they've now felt that they've been completely excluded from society.
So they don't have that loyalty, that connection, that care.
But also some of them are just nasty young men.
And you know what? Some of every culture are nasty young men.
Yep, they exist. But, you know, they're the ones that we've got to make sure that we're dealing, you know, in getting them before the courts and arresting them as soon as possible and delivering some timely and swift justice.
150 young men is, to be honest with you, that's more than I thought. That is actually a scary number to me, even though I know Melbourne's a big city, there's millions of us.
Yeah.
But, you know, what can you do about those guys? What's the process? Are you engaged daily or weekly and knocking on doors? What are you up to?
So, yeah, we've got a number of initiatives that we work with. But, you know, part of our role, what's the police role in all of this? So that we've got to provide some intensive supervision. If they've got bail conditions or parole conditions, we're going to make sure that they're complying with that. We've got to make sure that, you know, corrections are holding them accountable, and we are too. And we've certainly got to make sure that if they're stepping outside of those, we bring them back before the courts. But there's also a broader role for youth justice, and this is something that they're working through. There was a great review done by Jim Ogoff and Penny Armitage that talked about working on the real factors that underline their offending, and that's the way they're thinking. You know, and you mentioned here, how can they disassociate themselves from the impact of their offending?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a role for psychologists and people to work with them to make sure that they actually start to think through that and connect them back to the consequences of their action.
Elaine went and met some of her offenders, and there was only one who she felt did not understand, but she certainly felt that most of the other boys looked at her and they said things like, I've realised how much pain I have inflicted on you and even on my own mother. And, you know, they really did have those moments when they had to face her and see her PTSD and see this tiny little old lady who they've affected so badly.
Yeah. So that kind of work needs to be done, and it's, you know, it's something that will take time, and it's got to be intensive with some of those offenders that have moved beyond into that really high arm offending. It's not an easy thing for people to change their thinking.
But we've got to get them young, right? We've got to get the men when they're young enough to not have become that hardened and sort of abandoned.
What we've got to do is build a strong community where people feel welcome.
Yeah.
And if they feel welcome, if they feel part of it, it's a lot harder for people to move into that type of offending.
From your perspective, do you think the other rumour, the other thing people say and think is that it's cultural, men in their culture are violent? Can you speak to that?
I've seen no signs of that and no evidence of that, that there's any more violence in the South Sudanese community here in Victoria than any other. This type of offending is really worrying, no doubt. But when you start to generalise that that applies to all South Sudanese men, there's no evidence of that.
You may recall our pledge to help Elaine access counselling for her PTSD. Well, thanks to some excellent advice from Narelle Fraser, we started off by contacting the Office of the Victims of Crime Commissioner in Victoria, Greg Davies. His staff have told us that Elaine is definitely eligible for further support from them, and now they're in touch with her and working on a plan for making that happen. I'm sure she'll let me know if she's dissatisfied with the way that is going, but I really, really hope for her that she gets some great results. Thank you so much for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.